Welcome to Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Emily of New Moon. Beloved for her iconic role as Miss Stacy in the classic television series Anne of Green Gables, celebrated Canadian actress Marilyn Lightstone now returns to the world of Lucy Maud Montgomery and the magic of Prince Edward Island to bring to life the unforgettable coming-of-age story of the imaginative young heroine Emily Starr. If this is your first time joining us, you can find all episodes of Marilyn Lightstone Reads at classicalfm.ca or on your favorite podcast app. And now, let's turn to Marilyn as she reads Emily of New Moon.
Chapter 28, A Weaver of Dreams. It took Emily several weeks to make up her mind whether she liked Mr. Carpenter or not. She knew she did not dislike him, not even though his first greeting shot at her on the opening day of school in a gruff voice, accompanied by a startling lift of his spiky gray brows, was, "So, you're the girl that writes poetry, eh? Better stick to your needle and duster. Too many fools in the world trying to write poetry and failing. I tried it myself once. Got better sense now." "You don't keep your nails clean," thought Emily. But he upset every kind of school tradition so speedily and thoroughly that Ilsa, who gloried in upsetting things and hated routine, was the only scholar that liked him from the start. Some never liked him, the Rhoda Stewart type, for example, but most of them came to it after they got used to never being used to anything. And Emily finally decided that she liked him tremendously. Mr. Carpenter was somewhere between 40 and 50, a tall man with an upstanding shock of bushy gray hair, bristling gray mustache and eyebrows, a truculent beard, bright blue eyes out of which all his wild life had not yet burned the fire, and a long, lean, grayish face, deeply lined. He lived in a little two-roomed house below the school with a shy mouse of a wife. He never talked of his past, or offered any explanation of the fact that at his age he had no better profession than teaching a district school for a pittance of salary. But the truth leaked out after a while, for Prince Edward Island is a small province, and everybody in it knows something about everybody else. So eventually Blairwater people, and even the school children, understood that Mr. Carpenter had been a brilliant student in his youth and had had his eye on the ministry. But at college, he had got in with a fast set. Blairwater people nodded heads slowly and whispered the dreadful phrase portentously, and the fast set had ruined him. He took to drink and went to the dogs generally, and the upshot of it all was that Francis Carpenter, who had led his class in his first and second years at McGill, and for whom his teachers had predicted a great career, was a country school teacher at 45, with no prospect of ever being anything else. Perhaps he was resigned to it. Perhaps not. Nobody ever knew. Not even the brown mouse of a wife. Nobody in Blairwater cared. He was a good teacher, and that was all that mattered. Even if he did go on occasional sprees, he always took Saturday for them, and was sober enough by Monday. Sober and especially dignified, wearing a rusty black frock coat, which he never put on any other day of the week. He did not invite pity, and he did not pose as a tragedy. But sometimes, when Emily looked at his face, bent over the arithmetic problems of Blairwater School, she felt horribly sorry for him, without in the least understanding why. He had an explosive temper, which generally burst into flame at least once a day, and then he would storm about wildly for a few minutes, tugging at his beard, imploring heaven to grant him patience, abusing everybody in general, and the luckless object of his wrath in particular. But these tempers never lasted long. In a few minutes, Mr. Carpenter would be smiling as graciously as a sun bursting through a storm cloud on the very pupil he had been rating. Nobody seemed to cherish any grudge because of his scoldings. He never said any of the biting things Miss Brownell was wont to say, which rankled and festered for weeks. His hail of words fell alike on just and unjust, and rolled off harmlessly. He could take a joke on himself in perfect good nature. "Do you hear me? Do you hear me, Sarah?" he bellowed to Perry Miller one day. "Of course I hear you," retorted Perry coolly. "They could hear you in Charlottetown." Mr. Carpenter stared for a moment, then broke into a great, jolly laugh. His methods of teaching were so different from Miss Brownell's that the Blair Water pupils at first felt as if he had stood them on their heads. Miss Brownell had been a martinet for order. Mr. Carpenter never tried to keep order, apparently, but somehow he kept the children so busy that they had no time to do mischief. He taught history tempestuously for a month, making his pupils play the different characters and enact the incidents. He never bothered anyone to learn dates, but the dates stuck in the memory just the same. If, as Mary Queen of Scots, you were beheaded by the school axe, kneeling blindfolded at the doorstep, with Perry Miller wearing a mask made out of a piece of Aunt Laura's old black silk for executioner, wondering what would happen if he brought the axe down too hard, you did not forget the year it happened. And if you fought the Battle of Waterloo all over the school playground and heard Teddy Kent shouting, "Up, guards, and Adam!" as he led the last furious charge, you remembered 1815 without half trying to. Next month, history would be thrust aside altogether, and geography would take its place, when school and playground were mapped out into countries, and you dressed up as the animals inhabiting them, or traded in various commodities over their rivers and cities. When Rhoda Stewart had cheated you in a bargain in hides, you remembered that she had bought the cargo from the Argentine Republic. And when Perry Miller would not drink any water for a whole hot summer day because he was crossing the Arabian Desert with a caravan of camels and could not find an oasis, and then drank so much that he took terrible cramps, and Aunt Laura had to be up all night with him, you did not forget where the said desert was. The trustees were quite scandalized over some of the goings-on, and felt sure that the children were having too good a time to be really learning anything. If you wanted to learn Latin and French, you had to do it by talking your exercises, not writing them. And on Friday afternoons, all lessons were put aside, and Mr. Carpenter made the children recite poems, make speeches, and declaim passages from Shakespeare and the Bible. This was the day Ilse loved. Mr. Carpenter pounced on her gift like a starving dog on a bone and drilled her without mercy. They had endless fights, and Ilse stamped her foot and called him names while the other pupils wondered why she was not punished for it, but at last had to give in and do as he willed. Ilse went to school regularly, something she had never done before. Mr. Carpenter had told her that if she were absent for a day without good excuse, she could take no part in the Friday exercises, and this would have killed her. One day, Mr. Carpenter had picked up Teddy's slate and found a sketch of himself on it in one of his favorite, if not exactly beautiful, attitudes. Teddy had labeled it "The Black Death," half of the pupils of the school having died that day of the Great Plague, and having been carried out on stretchers to the Potter's Field by the terrified survivors. Teddy expected a roar of denunciation, for the day before, Garrett Marshall had been ground into figurative pulp on being discovered with the picture of a harmless cow on his slate. At least, Garrett said he meant it for a cow. But now, this amazing Mr. Carpenter only drew his beetling brows together, looked earnestly at Teddy's slate, put it down on the desk, looked at Teddy, and said, "I don't know anything about drawing. I can't help you, but, by gad, I think hereafter you'd better give up those extra arithmetic problems in the afternoon and draw pictures." Whereupon Garrett Marshall went home and told his father that old Carpenter wasn't fair and made favorites over Teddy Kent. Mr. Carpenter went up to the tansy patch that evening and saw the sketches in Teddy's old barn loft studio. Then he went into the house and talked to Mrs. Kent. What he said and what she said, nobody ever knew. But Mr. Carpenter went away looking grim, as if he had met an unexpected match. He took great pains with Teddy's general schoolwork after that, and procured from somewhere certain elementary textbooks on drawing, which he gave him, telling him not to take them home, a caution Teddy did not require. He knew quite well that if he did, they would disappear as mysteriously as his cats had done. He had taken Emily's advice and told his mother he would not love her if anything happened to Leo. And Leo flourished and waxed fat and doggy. But Teddy was too gentle at heart and too fond of his mother to make such a threat more than once. He knew she had cried all that night after Mr. Carpenter had been there, and prayed on her knees in her little bedroom most of the next day, and looked at him with bitter, haunting eyes for a whole week. He wished she were more like other fellows' mothers, but they loved each other very much, and had dear hours together in the little grey house on the Tansy Hill. It was only when other people were about that Mrs. Kent was queer and jealous. "She's always lovely when we're alone," Teddy had told Emily. As for the other boys, Perry Miller was the only one Mr. Carpenter bothered much with in the way of speeches, and he was as merciless with him as with Ilsa. Perry worked hard to please him and practiced his speeches in barn and field and even by nights in the kitchen loft, until Aunt Elizabeth put a stop to that. Emily could not understand why Mr. Carpenter would smile amiably and say, "Very good," when Nettie Grant rattled off a speech glibly, without any expression whatever, and then rage at Perry and denounce him as a dunce and a nincompoop, by gad, because he had failed to give just the proper emphasis on a certain word, or had timed his gesture a fraction of a second too soon. Neither could she understand why he made red pencil corrections all over her compositions, and rated her for split infinitives and too lavish adjectives, and strolled up and down the aisle and hurled objurgations at her because she didn't know a good place to stop when she saw it, by gad. And then told Rhoda Stewart and Nan Lee that their compositions were very pretty, and gave them back without so much as a mark on them. Yet in spite of it all, she liked him more and more as time went on, and autumn passed, and winter came, with its beautiful bare-limbed trees, and soft pearl-gray skies that were slashed with rifts of gold in the afternoons, and cleared to a jeweled pageantry of stars over the wide white hills and valleys around New Moon. Emily shot up so that winter that Aunt Laura had to let down the tucks in her dresses. Aunt Ruth, who had come for a week's visit, said she was outgrowing her strength. Consumptive children always did. "I am not consumptive," Emily said. "The stars are tall," she added, with a touch of subtle malice hardly to be looked for in near 13. Aunt Ruth, who was sensitive in regard to her dumpiness, sniffed. "It would be well if that were the only thing in which you resemble them," she said. "How are you getting on in school?" "Very well. I am the smartest scholar in my class," answered Emily, composedly.
"You conceited child," said Aunt Ruth.
"I'm not conceited."
Emily looked scornful indignation.
"Mr. Carpenter said it, and he doesn't flatter. Besides, I can't help seeing it myself."
"Well, it is to be hoped you have some brains, because you haven't much in the way of looks," said Aunt Ruth. "You've no complexion to speak of, and that inky hair round your white face is startling. I see you're going to be a plain girl."
"You wouldn't say that to a grown-up person's face," said Emily, with a deliberate gravity which always exasperated Aunt Ruth, because she could not understand it in a child. I don't think it would hurt you to be as polite to me as you are to other people.
I'm telling you your faults, so you may correct them, said Aunt Ruth frigidly.
It isn't my fault that my face is pale and my hair black, protested Emily. I can't correct that.
If you were a different girl, said Aunt Ruth, I would...
But I don't want to be a different girl, said Emily decidedly. She had no intention of lowering the star flag to Aunt Ruth. I wouldn't want to be anybody but myself, even if I am plain. Besides, she added impressively as she turned to go out of the room, though I may not be very good-looking now, when I go to heaven, I believe I'll be very beautiful.
Some people think Emily is quite pretty, said Aunt Laura. But she did not say it until Emily was out of hearing. She was merry enough for that. I don't know where they see it, said Aunt Ruth. She's vain and pert, and says things to be thought smart. You heard her just now.
But the thing I dislike most in her is that she is unchildlike and deep as the sea.
Yes, she is, Laura, deep as the sea. You'll find it out to your cost one day if you disregard my warning. She's capable of anything. Sly is no word for it. You and Elizabeth don't keep a tight enough rein over her.
I've done my best, said Elizabeth stiffly. She herself did think she had been much too lenient with Emily. Laura and Jimmy were 2-1, but it nettled her to have Ruth say so. Uncle Wallace also had an attack of worrying over Emily that winter. He looked at her one day when he was at New Moon and remarked that she was getting to be a big girl.
How old are you, Emily?
He asked her that every time he came to New Moon.
13 in May.
What are you going to do with her, Elizabeth?
I don't know what you mean, said Aunt Elizabeth coldly, or as coldly as it is possible to speak when one is pouring melted tallow into candle moulds.
Why, she'll soon be grown up. She can't expect you to provide for her indefinitely.
I don't, Emily whispered resentfully under her breath.
And it's time we decided what is best to be done for her.
The Murray women have never had to work out for a living, said Aunt Elizabeth, as if that disposed of the matter.
Emily is only half Murray, said Wallace. Besides, times are changing. You and Laura will not live forever, Elizabeth. And when you are gone, New Moon goes to Oliver's Andrew. In my opinion, Emily should be fitter to support herself, if necessary.
Emily did not like Uncle Wallace, but she was very grateful to him at that moment. Whatever his motives were, he was proposing the very thing she secretly yearned for.
I would suggest, said Uncle Wallace, that she be sent to Queen's Academy to get a teacher's license. Teaching is a genteel, ladylike occupation. I will do my share in providing for the expense of it.
A blind person might have seen that Uncle Wallace thought this very splendid of himself.
If you do, thought Emily, I'll pay every cent back to you as soon as I'm able to earn it.
But Aunt Elizabeth was adamant.
I do not believe in girls going out into the world, she said. I don't mean Emily to go to Queen's. I told Mr. Carpenter so when he came to see me about her taking up the entrance work. He was very rude. Schoolteachers knew their place better in my father's time. But I made him understand, I think. I'm rather surprised at you, Wallace. You did not send your own daughter out to work.
My daughter had parents to provide for her,
retorted Uncle Wallace pompously.
Emily is an orphan. I imagined from what I had heard about her that she would prefer earning her own living to living on charity.
So I would, cried out Emily. So I would, Uncle Wallace. Oh, Aunt Elizabeth, please let me study for the entrance. Please. I'll pay you back every cent you spent on it. I will indeed. I pledge you my word of honor.
It does not happen to be a question of money, said Aunt Elizabeth, in her stateliest manner. I undertook to provide for you, Emily, and I will do it. When you are older, I may send you to the high school in Shrewsbury for a couple of years. I am not decrying education. But you are not going to be a slave to the public. No merry girl ever was that.
Emily, realizing the uselessness of pleading, went out in the same bitter disappointment she had felt after Mr. Carpenter's visit. Then Aunt Elizabeth looked at Wallace.
"Have you forgotten what came of sending Julia to Queen's?"
she asked significantly. If Emily was not allowed to take up the entrance classes, Perry had no one to say him nay, and he went at them with the same dogged determination that he showed in all other matters. Perry's status at New Moon had changed subtly and steadily. Aunt Elizabeth had ceased to refer scornfully to him as a hired boy. Even she recognized that though he was still indubitably a hired boy, he was not going to remain one, and she no longer objected to Laura's patching up his ragged bits of clothing, or to Emily's helping him with his lessons in the kitchen after supper. Nor did she growl when Cousin Jimmy began to pay him a certain small wage, though older boys than Perry were still glad to put in the winter months touring for board and lodging in some comfortable home. If a future premier was in the making at New Moon, Aunt Elizabeth wanted to have some small share in the making. It was credible and commendable that a boy should have ambitions. A girl was an entirely different matter. A girl's place was at home. Emily helped Perry work out algebra problems and heard his lessons in French and Latin. She picked up more thus than Aunt Elizabeth would have approved, and more still when the entrance pupils talked those languages in school. It was quite an easy matter for a girl who at once upon a time invented a language of her own. When George Bates, by way of showing off, asked her one day in French, his French, of which Mr. Carpenter at once said doubtfully that perhaps God might understand it, "Have you the ink of my grandmother and the shoe-brush of my cousin and the umbrella of my aunt's husband in your desk?" Emily retorted quite as glibly and quite as Frenchily, "No, but I have the pen of your father and the cheese of the innkeeper and the towel of your uncle's maidservant in my basket." To console herself for her disappointment in regard to the entrance class, Emily wrote more poetry than ever. It was especially delightful to write poetry on a winter evening, when the storm winds howled without and heaped the garden and orchard with big ghostly drifts, starred over with rabbit's candles. She also wrote several stories, desperate love affairs, wherein she struggled heroically against the difficulties of affectionate dialogue. Tales of bandits and pirates. Emily liked these because there was no necessity for bandits and pirates to converse lovingly. Tragedies of earls and countesses, whose conversation she dearly loved to pepper with scraps of French, and a dozen other subjects she didn't know anything about. She also meditated beginning a novel, but decided it would be too hard to get enough paper for it. The letter bills were all done now, and the Jimmy books were not big enough, though a new one always appeared mysteriously in her school basket when the old one was almost full. Cousin Jimmy seemed to have an uncanny prescience of the proper time. That was part of his Jimminess. Then one night, as she lay in her lookout bed and watched a full moon gleaming lustrously from a cloudless sky across the valley, she had a sudden, dazzling idea. She would send her latest poem to the Charlottetown Enterprise. The Enterprise had a poet's corner where original verses were frequently printed. Privately, Emily thought her own were quite as good, as probably they were, for most of the Enterprise poems were sad trash. Emily was so excited over the idea that she could not sleep for the greater part of the night, and didn't want to. It was glorious to lie there, thrilling in the darkness, and picture the whole thing out. She saw her verses in print signed E. Birdstar. She saw Aunt Laura's eyes shining with pride. She saw Mr. Carpenter pointing them out to strangers. "The work of a pupil of mine, by gad." She saw all her schoolmates envying her, or admiring, according to type. She saw herself with one foot at least firmly planted on the ladder of fame. One hill at least of the Alpine path crested, with a new and glorious prospect opening therefrom. Morning came. Emily went to school, so absent-minded because of her secret that she did badly in everything and was raged at by Mr. Carpenter. But it all slipped off her like the proverbial water off a duck's back. Her body was in Blair Water School, but her spirit was in Kingdom's Imperial. As soon as school was out, she betook herself to the garret with half a sheet of blue-lined notepaper. Very painstakingly, she copied down the poem, being especially careful to dot every I and cross every T. She wrote it on both sides of the paper, being in blissful ignorance of any taboo thereon. Then she read it aloud delightedly, not omitting the title, Evening Dreams. There was one line in it she tasted two or three times. The haunting elfin music of the air. I think that line is very good, said Emily. I wonder now how I happened to think of it. She mailed her poem the next day and lived in a delicious mystic rapture until the following Saturday. When the Enterprise came, she opened it with tremulous eagerness and ice-cold fingers, and turned to the Poet's Corner. Now, for her great moment! There was not a sign of an evening dream about it. Emily threw down the Enterprise and fled to the garret dormer, where, face downward on the old haircloth sofa, she wept out her bitterness of disappointment. She drained the draught of failure to the very dregs. It was horribly real and tragic to her. She felt exactly as she had been slapped in the face. She was crushed in the very dust of humiliation and was sure she could never rise again. How thankful she was that she hadn't told Teddy anything about it. She had been so strongly tempted to, and only refrained because she didn't want to spoil the dramatic surprise of the moment when she would show him the verses with her name signed to them. She had told Perry, and Perry was furious when he saw her tear-stained face later on in the dairy as they strained the milk together. Ordinarily, Emily loved this, but tonight the savor had gone out of the world. Even the milky splendor of the still, mild winter evening and the purple bloom over the hillside woods that presaged a thaw could not give her the accustomed soul thrill. "I'm going to Charlottetown if I have to walk, and I'll bust that Enterprise editor's head," said Perry, with the expression which, 30 years later, warned the members of his party to scatter for cover. "That wouldn't be any use," said Emily, drearily. "He didn't think it good enough to print. That is what hurts me so, Perry. He didn't think it any good. Busting his head wouldn't change that." It took her a week to recover from the blow. Then she wrote a story in which the editor of the Enterprise played the part of a dark and desperate villain who found lodgings eventually behind prison bars. This got the venom out of her system, and she forgot all about him in the delight of writing a poem addressed to Sweet Lady April. But I question if she ever really forgave him. Even when she discovered eventually that you must not write on both sides of the paper, even when she read over Evening Dreams a year later and wondered how she could ever have thought it any good. This sort of thing was happening frequently now. Every time she read her little hoard of manuscripts over, she found some of which the fairy gold had unaccountably turned to withered leaves, fit only for the burning. Emily burned them, but it hurt her a little. Outgrowing things we love is never a pleasant process. Chapter 29. Sacrilege. There had been several clashes between Aunt Elizabeth and Emily that winter and spring. Generally, Aunt Elizabeth came out victorious. There was that in her that would not be denied the satisfaction of having her own way, even in trifling matters. But once in a while, she came up against that curious streak of granite in Emily's composition, which was unyielding and unbendable and unbreakable. Mary Murray, of 100 years agone, had been, so family chronicle ran, a gentle and submissive creature generally. But she had that same streak in her, as her "here I stay" abundantly testified. When Aunt Elizabeth tried conclusions with that element in Emily, she always got the worst of it. Yet she did not learn wisdom therefrom, but pursued her policy of repression all the more rigorously, for it occasionally came home to her, as Laura let down tucks, that Emily was on the verge of beginning to grow up, and that various breakers and reefs loomed ahead, ominously magnified in the mist of unseen years. Emily must not be allowed to get out of hand now, lest later on she make shipwreck as her mother had done, or as Elizabeth Murray firmly believed she had done. There were, in short, to be no more elopements from New Moon. One of the things they fell out about was the fact that Emily, as Aunt Elizabeth discovered one day, was in the habit of using more of her egg money to buy paper than Aunt Elizabeth approved of. What did Emily do with so much paper? They had a fuss over this, and eventually Aunt Elizabeth discovered that Emily was writing stories. Emily had been writing stories all winter under Aunt Elizabeth's very nose, and Aunt Elizabeth had never suspected it. She had fondly supposed that Emily was writing school compositions. Aunt Elizabeth knew in a vague way that Emily wrote silly rhymes, which he called poetry. But this did not worry her especially. Jimmy made up a lot of similar trash. It was foolish, but harmless, and Emily would doubtless outgrow it. Jimmy had not outgrown it, to be sure, but then his accident— Elizabeth always went a little sick in soul when she remembered it, had made him more or less a child for life. But writing stories was a very different thing, and Aunt Elizabeth was horrified. Fiction of any kind was an abominable thing. Elizabeth Murray had been trained up in this belief in her youth, and in her age she had not departed from it. She honestly thought that it was a wicked and sinful thing in anyone to play cards, dance, or go to the theater, read or write novels. And in Emily's case, there was a worse feature. It was the star coming out in her. Douglas Star, especially. No Murray of New Moon had ever been guilty of writing stories, or of ever wanting to write them. It was an alien growth that must be pruned off ruthlessly. Aunt Elizabeth applied the pruning shears and found no pliant, snippable root, but that same underlying streak of granite. Emily was respectful and reasonable and above board. She bought no more paper with egg money, but she told Aunt Elizabeth that she could not give up writing stories, and she went right on writing them on pieces of brown wrapping paper and the blank backs of circulars which agricultural machinery firms sent Cousin Jimmy. "Don't you know that it is wicked to write novels?" demanded Aunt Elizabeth. "Oh, I'm not writing novels yet," said Emily. "I can't get enough paper. These are just short stories. And it isn't wicked. Father likes novels." "Your father," began Aunt Elizabeth, and stopped. She remembered that Emily had acted up before now when anything derogatory was said of her father. But the very fact that she felt mysteriously compelled to stop annoyed Elizabeth, who had said what seemed good to her all her life at New Moon without much regard for other people's feelings. "You will not write any more of this stuff," Aunt Elizabeth contemptuously flourished. "The Secret of the Castle," under Emily's nose. "I forbid you, remember. I forbid you. Oh, I must write Aunt Elizabeth, said Emily, gravely, folding her slender, beautiful hands on the table and looking straight into Aunt Elizabeth's angry face with the steady, unblinking gaze which Aunt Ruth called unchildlike. You see, it's this way. It is in me. I can't help it. And Father said I was always to keep on writing. He said I would be famous some day. Wouldn't you like to have a famous niece, Aunt Elizabeth?
I am not going to argue the matter, said Aunt Elizabeth.
I'm not arguing, only explaining. Emily was exasperatingly respectful. I just want you to understand how it is that I have to go on writing stories, even though I am so very sorry you don't approve.
If you don't give this up, this worse-than-nonsense, Emily, I'll...
Aunt Elizabeth stopped, not knowing what to say she would do. Emily was too big now to be slapped or shut up, and it was no use to say, as she was tempted to, I'll send you away from New Moon, because Elizabeth Murray knew perfectly well she would not send Emily away from New Moon. Could not send her away, indeed, though this knowledge was as yet only in her feelings and had not yet been translated into her intellect. She only felt that she was helpless, and it angered her. But Emily was mistress of the situation and calmly went on writing stories. If Aunt Elizabeth had asked her to give up crocheting lace or making molasses taffy or eating Aunt Laura's delicious drop cookies, Emily would have done so wholly and cheerfully, though she loved these things. But to give up writing stories? Why, Aunt Elizabeth might as well have asked her to give up breathing. Why couldn't she understand? It seemed so simple and indisputable to Emily. Teddy can't help making pictures, and Ilse can't help reciting, and I can't help writing. Don't you see, Aunt Elizabeth?
I see that you are an ungrateful and disobedient child, said Aunt Elizabeth.
This hurt Emily horribly, but she could not give in. And there continued to be a sense of soreness and disapproval between her and Aunt Elizabeth in all the little details of daily life that poisoned existence more or less for the child, who was so keenly sensitive to her environment and to the feelings with which her kindred regarded her. Emily felt it all the time, except when she was writing her stories. Then she forgot everything, roaming in some enchanted country between the sun and moon, where she saw wonderful beings whom she tried to describe, and wonderful deeds which she tried to record, coming back to the candlelit kitchen with a somewhat dazed sense of having been years in no man's land. She did not even have Aunt Laura to back her up in the matter. Aunt Laura thought Emily ought to yield in such an unimportant matter, and please Aunt Elizabeth. But it's not unimportant, said Emily, despairingly. It's the most important thing in the world to me, Aunt Laura. Oh, I thought you would understand.
I understand that you like to do it, dear, and I think it's a harmless enough amusement. But it seems to annoy Elizabeth some way, and I do think you might give it up on that account. It is not as if it was anything that mattered much. It is really a waste of time.
No, no, said distressed Emily. Why, some day, Aunt Laura, I'll write real books and make lots of money, she added, sensing that the businesslike Murrays measured the nature of most things on a cash basis. Aunt Laura smiled indulgently.
I'm afraid you'll never grow rich that way, dear. It would be wiser to employ your time preparing yourself for some useful work. It was maddening to be condescended to like this. Maddening that nobody could see that she had to write. Maddening to have Aunt Laura so sweet and loving and stupid about it.
Oh, thought Emily bitterly, if that hateful Enterprise editor had printed my piece, they'd have believed then.
At any rate, advised Aunt Laura, don't let Elizabeth see you writing them. But somehow, Emily could not take this prudent advice. There had been occasions when she had connived with Aunt Laura to hoodwink Aunt Elizabeth on some little matter,
but she found she could not do it in this. This had to be open and above board. She must write stories, and Aunt Elizabeth must know it. That was the way it had to be. She could not be false to herself in this. She could not pretend to be false.
She wrote her father all about it, poured out her bitterness and perplexity to him in what, though she did not suspect it at the time, was the last letter she was to write him. There was a large bundle of letters by now on the old sofa shelf in the garret, for Emily had written many letters to her father besides those which have been chronicled in this history. There were a great many paragraphs about Aunt Elizabeth in them, most of them very uncomplimentary, and some of them, as Emily herself would have owned when her first bitterness was past, overdrawn and exaggerated. They had been written in moments when her hurt and angry soul demanded some outlet for its emotion, and barbed her pen with venom. Emily was mistress of a subtly malicious style when she chose to be. After she had written them, the hurt had ceased, and she thought no more about them. But they remained. And one spring day, Aunt Elizabeth, house-cleaning in the garret while Emily played happily with Teddy at the tansy patch, found the bundle of letters on the sofa shelf, sat down, and read them all. Elizabeth Murray would never have read any writing belonging to a grown-up person, but it never occurred to her that there was anything dishonorable in reading the letters wherein Emily, lonely and sometimes misunderstood, had poured out her heart to the father she had loved and been loved by so passionately and understandingly. Aunt Elizabeth thought she had a right to know everything that this pensioner on her bounty did, said, or thought. She read the letters, and she found out what Emily thought of her. Of her, Elizabeth Murray, autocrat unchallenged, to whom no one had ever dared to say anything uncomplimentary. Such an experience is no pleasanter at 60 than at 16. As Elizabeth Murray folded up the last letter, her hands trembled with anger, and something underneath it that was not anger.
"Emily, your Aunt Elizabeth wants to see you in the parlour," said Aunt Laura, when Emily returned from the tansy patch, driven home by the thin grey rain that had begun to drift over the greening fields. Her tone, her sorrowful look, warned Emily that mischief was in the wind. Emily had no idea what mischief. She could not recall anything she had done recently that should bring her up before the tribunal Aunt Elizabeth occasionally held in the parlour. It must be serious when it was in the parlour. For reasons best known to herself, Aunt Elizabeth held super-serious interviews like this in the parlour. Possibly it was because she felt obscurely that the photographs of the Murrays on the walls gave her a backing she needed when dealing with this hop out of kin. For the same reason, Emily detested a trial in the parlour. She always felt on such occasions like a very small mouse surrounded by a circle of grim cats. Emily skipped across the big hall, pausing, in spite of her alarm, to glance at the charming red world through the crimson glass, then pushed open the parlour door. The room was dim, for only one of the slat blinds was partially raised. Aunt Elizabeth was sitting bolt upright in Grandfather Murray's black horsehair chair. Emily looked at her stern, angry face first, and then at her lap. Emily understood. The first thing she did was to retrieve her precious letters. With the quickness of light, she sprang to Aunt Elizabeth, snatched up the bundle, and retreated to the door. There she faced Aunt Elizabeth, her face blazing with indignation and outrage. Sacrilege had been committed. The most sacred shrine of her soul had been profaned. "How dare you?" she said. "How dare you touch my private papers, Aunt Elizabeth?" Aunt Elizabeth had not expected this. She had looked for confusion, dismay, shame, fear, for anything but this righteous indignation, as if she, forsooth, were the guilty one. She rose. "Give me those letters, Emily." "No, I will not," said Emily, white with anger, as she clasped her hands round the bundle. "They are mine and father's, not yours. You had no right to touch them. I will never forgive you." This was turning the tables with a vengeance. Aunt Elizabeth was so dumbfounded that she hardly knew what to say or do. Worst of all, a most unpleasant doubt of her own conduct suddenly assailed her, driven home perhaps by the intensity and earnestness of Emily's accusation. For the first time in her life, it occurred to Elizabeth Murray to wonder if she had done rightly. For the first time in her life, she felt ashamed. And the shame made her furious. It was intolerable that she should be made to feel ashamed. For the moment, they faced each other, not as aunt and niece, not as child and adult, but as two human beings, each with hatred for the other in her heart. Elizabeth Murray, tall and austere and thin-lipped. Emily Starr, white of face, her eyes pools of black flame, her trembling arms hugging her letters. "So, this is your gratitude," said Aunt Elizabeth. "You were a penniless orphan. I took you to my home. I have given you shelter and food and education and kindness. And this is my thanks." As yet, Emily's tempest of anger and resentment prevented her from feeling the sting of this. "You did not want to take me," she said. "You made me draw lots, and you took me because the lot fell to you. You knew some of you had to take me because you were the proud Murrays and couldn't let a relation go to an orphan asylum. Aunt Laura loves me now, but you don't. So why should I love you?" "Ungrateful, thankless child. I'm not thankless. I've tried to be good. I've tried to obey you and please you. I do all the chores I can to help pay for my keep. And you had no business to read my letters to father." "They are disgraceful letters and must be destroyed," said Aunt Elizabeth. "No." Emily clasped them tighter. "I'd sooner burn myself. You shall not have them, Aunt Elizabeth." She felt her brows drawing together. She felt the Murray look on her face. She knew she was conquering. Elizabeth Murray turned paler, if that were possible. There were times when she could give the Murray look herself. It was not that which dismayed her. It was the uncanny something which seemed to peer out behind the Murray look that always broke her will. She trembled. Faltered. Yielded. "Keep your letters," she said bitterly, "and scorn the old woman who opened her home to you." She went out of the parlour. Emily was left mistress of the field. And all at once, her victory turned to dust and ashes in her mouth. She went up to her own room, hid her letters in the cupboard over the mantel, and then crept up on her bed, huddling down in a little heap with her face buried in her pillow. She was still sore with a sense of outrage, but underneath, another pain was beginning to ache terribly. Something in her was hurt because she had hurt Aunt Elizabeth, for she felt that Aunt Elizabeth, under all her anger, was hurt. This surprised Emily. She would have expected Aunt Elizabeth to be angry, of course, but she would never have supposed it would affect her in any other way. Yet she had seen something in Aunt Elizabeth's eyes when she had flung that last stinging sentence at her, something that spoke of bitter hurt. "Oh, oh," gasped Emily. She began to cry chokingly into her pillow. She was so wretched that she could not get out of herself and watch her own suffering with a sort of enjoyment in its drama. Set her mind to analyze her feelings, and when Emily was as wretched as that, She was very wretched indeed, and wholly comfortless. Aunt Elizabeth would not keep her at New Moon after a poisonous quarrel like this. She would send her away, of course. Emily believed this. Nothing was too horrible to believe just then. How could she live away from dear New Moon? And I may have to live 80 years, Emily moaned. But worse even than this was the remembrance of that look in Aunt Elizabeth's eyes. Her own sense of outrage and sacrilege ebbed away under the remembrance. She thought of all the things she had written her father about Aunt Elizabeth. Sharp, bitter things, some of them just, some of them unjust. She began to feel that she should not have written them. It was true enough that Aunt Elizabeth had not loved her, had not wanted to take her to New Moon, but she had taken her. And though it had been done in duty, not in love, the fact remained. It was no use for her to tell herself that it wasn't as if the letters were written to anyone living, to be seen and read by others. While she was under Aunt Elizabeth's roof, while she owed the food she ate and the clothes she wore to Aunt Elizabeth, she should not say, even to her father, harsh things of her. A star should not have done it. I must go and ask Aunt Elizabeth to forgive me, thought Emily at last, all the passion gone out of her and only regret and repentance left. I suppose she never will. She'll hate me always now. But I must go. She turned herself about, and then the door opened, and Aunt Elizabeth entered. She came across the room and stood at the side of the bed, looking down at the grieved little face on the pillow. A face that in the dim, rainy twilight, with its tear stains and black shadowed eyes, looked strangely mature and chiseled. Elizabeth Murray was still austere and cold. Her voice sounded stern, but she said an amazing thing. Emily, I had no right to read your letters. I admit I was wrong. Will you forgive me?
Oh!
The word was almost a cry. Aunt Elizabeth had at last discerned the way to conquer Emily. The latter lifted herself up, flung her arms about Aunt Elizabeth, and said chokingly, Oh, Aunt Elizabeth, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have written those things. But I wrote them when I was vexed, and I didn't mean them all truly. I didn't mean the worst of them. Oh, you'll believe that, won't you, Aunt Elizabeth?
I'd like to believe it, Emily.
An odd quiver passed through the tall, rigid form. I don't like to think that you hate me, my sister's child. Little Juliet's child.
Oh, I don't. Oh, I don't,
sobbed Emily.
And I'll love you, Aunt Elizabeth, if you'll let me, if you want me to. I didn't think you cared. Oh, dear Aunt Elizabeth.
Emily gave Aunt Elizabeth a fierce hug and a passionate kiss on the white, fine, wrinkled cheek. Aunt Elizabeth kissed her gravely on the brow in return, and then said, as if closing the door on the whole incident, You'd better wash your face and come down to supper. But there was yet something to be cleared up.
Aunt Elizabeth, whispered Emily, I can't burn those letters, you know. They belong to Father. But I'll tell you what I will do. I'll go over them all and put a star by anything I said about you. And then I'll add an explanatory footnote saying that I was mistaken.
Emily spent her spare time for several days putting in her explanatory footnotes, and then her conscience had rest. But when she again tried to write a letter to her father, she found that it no longer meant anything to her. The sense of reality, nearness, of close communion, had gone. Perhaps she had been outgrowing it gradually, as childhood began to merge into girlhood. Perhaps the bitter scene with Aunt Elizabeth had only shaken into dust something out of which the spirit had already departed. But whatever the explanation, it was not possible to write such letters any more. She missed them terribly, but she could not go back to them. A certain door of life was shut behind her and could not be reopened.
Thank you for listening to Marilyn Lightstone Reads, part of the Zoomer Podcast Network. This episode was produced by Duncan Briggs, executive producer Moses Neimer. Discover more of Marilyn's readings, including Pride and Prejudice, Sense and Sensibility, Vanity Fair, Jane Eyre, and Anne of Green Gables at classicalfm.ca or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also support this series by recommending it to your friends and leaving a 5-star review. Marilyn Lightstone Reads, beautiful stories, beautifully read for a crazy world.